glad that you know me. If you didn't know me, I couldn't be here today. So it's a wonderful thing. I'd like to thank Reb Shmuel Oren and the Skokie Kollel for inviting me on this wonderful day. July 4th is a monumental day in the history of our country. And actually, today is also the anniversary of the raid of Entebbe, if you remember, which took place, I think, in 1976, July 4th.
On the bicentennial, the American bicentennial.
That's right, it was the American bicentennial. I think it's a great credit to the Skokie Kollel for having an event like this to honor the military, and Jews in the military, and it's one thing I don't see too much in the Jewish community, in the religious community, or in any part of the Jewish community, is acknowledgement of the patriotism of American Jews. I don't see this on Veterans Day, I don't see it on Memorial Day or July 4th, and we're a little bit, in my opinion, remiss that we live in such a free country, and there are Jews who have served in every war, and that are presently serving, and we say very little about them. I'd like to spend some time with some stories and reflections, as the title of this talk has been described as, and then invite some questions about life in the military. In my own family, it's interesting, I just found out the history of my first name. My Hebrew name is Kalman, and Kenneth in English, but I never knew who he was. Part of the family came from Ukraine and from Kiev, and there was relatives who didn't come. Some came in 1990. They came, you know, from the old Soviet Union. But I never knew who he was. I said, who is Kalman? He's a nice guy. That was one of, he says, maybe a communist, because there were people who didn't come before 1918, were after 1918, they were probably Jewish communists, most likely. He could have been. But then I found out recently through Gina, and we have a family tree that somebody put together, and Kalman happened to be a first cousin once removed. I thought maybe he was an uncle. I didn't know. But not only that, he was a fighter in the resistance. And he was stationed in the area of Minsk. And he fought against the Nazis, and I guess he died. So I found out about who I was about 65 years after I was born. I was looking for my identity. I finally found my identity. And the other part of my identity, my first name is Pinchas, and that was my father's brother who was killed in World War II at the Battle of the Bulge. So I was named after him. So somehow I was destined to be a soldier in the American Army. And a chaplain, first and foremost, is a soldier with a commission, with a rank. And people ask me, do you have to do physical fitness? Do you have to go to basic training? All these, you know, and the answer is all of the above, but the basic training is basic training in chaplain school, not at basic training for privates, because we weren't privates. We were officers and we had our own school. So it was a lot different. We were not harassed too much. Maybe a little bit, but not too much. And we did have to go to physical fitness. And it depends on what unit we were in, and we had to run and take physical fitness tests. And I guess during Ronald Reagan's administration, they even had weigh-ins. We had to weigh in twice a year to see that we're at a certain weight. So too many breakfasts of lox and bagels and cream cheese maybe was to the detriment of some of us. For me, for sure. just to let you know, I came into the military in 1975. And it was interesting. In those days, it was post-Vietnam. So every era has it's a different era. So the experiences in World War II, the experiences of Korea, and what's going on since 9/11 are very different. I was in the military when there wasn't too many wars. There was a lot of training to go to war against the Russians, against the Soviet Union, because I was in during the middle of the Cold War, where East Germany and West Germany were separate countries. And you needed special permission to go to Berlin. I never made it to Berlin. I was in Germany. It was very interesting. If you wanted to go to Berlin and you were an American soldier, the only way to get there was either to drive. But when you're driving, you're going through East Berlin, East Germany. And if you go through East Germany and if you're stopped for speeding or something like that, you're in trouble, because then you have the East German military. So you would have to ask for the Russian army to help you, because they're in the eastern part, the United States and the old Soviet Union were allies, because they both fought on the same side. Other than that, they weren't allies, but there they were. So I would like to go through some of the places I was at and some of my experiences and stories, because there were some of them were pretty funny. Now I the only war that I could have gone to, I mean real war, was in 1990 in the first. When we went into Kuwait to rescue during the first Iraq war. I didn't go. I was alerted after the war was over. I'm gonna be going for 3 months during the summer. And I said, I'll go if you want me to go. But then they decided, well, we want you to stay there for 6 months. And I said, well, could you take somebody else? And they said, fine. So I didn't go. When I went to chaplain school in 1975 at Fort Wadsworth, Staten Island. Anybody here of Staten Island? A few people. So there's a base called Fort Wadsworth. By the bridge. I think so. And there's also Navy out there in Staten Island. That's where we were. And there was five rabbis in the basic course. We were with 100 chaplains, 95 Christian chaplains, and 5 rabbis. And at that time, every rabbi that went to school with me in the chaplain school, which was about 2 months, were Orthodox. We were all from YU. Just to show you the culture differences between us and our fellow citizens, I remember one day, it was over the weekend, we didn't have any training at all. And I went to the local kosher, or whatever it was, and I got a lox and bagel sandwich. So on the next day, I go on the bus. We were going to go to Fort Hamilton for the day, which is also across the bridge. And somebody says to me, one of the other chaplains, well, so what did you do? I said, I got a lox and bagel sandwich. You got a what? You ate lox? No, lox, smoked salmon, you know. They didn't understand what I was. The guy was probably from Arkansas or Mississippi or something. So he never heard of lox. You know, I said, all right, very good. But it was good. Anyways, some very interesting events happened in chaplain basic course, which are very humorous. That If I would have been a private, I wouldn't have gotten away with how I acted, but I got away with it. So once we were taking a map reading course. We had to learn how to read maps, coordinates. I don't know if they do that in school today, to read maps, but like coordinates, you know, and on a map. So we're in the middle of some place. We have to know where we're going, otherwise we have a problem. So the instructor who was, I think, an artillery officer and really didn't want to be at the chaplain school. It was beneath his dignity to teach a bunch of holy rollers when he could be out with, you know, artillery doing other things. But he was there. And he said in the middle of the class, he says, you know, it took the children of Israel 40 years to cross the desert. You know why? Because they should have crossed it in 7 days. You know, they didn't take my map reading course. They would have passed it in 7 days. So I didn't like that so much. So I either raised my hand or I didn't raise my hand. And then he says, you know, I said, listen, Moses was just following orders. He had a higher authority, you know. In fact, we went to Fort Dix, which used to be basic training, real basic training, which is in New Jersey. And we were there for a whole week. And we had to take a compass course in the woods. And the guy said, the same guy said to me, he says, we don't want to, you know, have to get you in the swamps because, you know, you guys don't know how to read maps because, you know, it took your people 40 years to cross the desert. So I said the same thing again. But it's very interesting. That same map reading course, there was one chaplain who was a Seventh-day Adventist. So he wanted to get home. This, I think, was on Thursday. But he wanted to get home, you know, get back so he could celebrate the Sabbath too, like us. So he chose me to be his partner because he figures I got to get home too. So that's interesting, you know. And for 25-6 years of my life, I was in day schools, yeshivot, and now I'm hanging around Seventh-day Adventists and other people. And for the next 20 years or so, my people who were over me were Southern Baptists and priests and Methodists. You know, I didn't have any Jewish presidents to deal with for 20 years. That's why I look the way I look. I still have some red hair, you know. That's one thing in the military. You do have on military bases, you have what they call lay leaders. Like, you want to call it like a president of a shul. But the difference is the chaplains appoint them. They could fire them. Here, the opposite. President can fire you. There, we fire them. And I did. I fired a retired colonel. He was a colonel, a West Pointer, and I didn't like him so much. He had some issues with me. So I got rid of him. So, but you don't see that too much in the civilian world. So not only did I serve Jewish, it's one of the interesting things, I came in the Army post-Vietnam, so they were already, and post-draft, the draft just finished, so it was in between two armies, a draft army and a volunteer army, so they began to change the thinking of how to utilize chaplains, in particular denominational chaplains like Jews and Catholics. So they assigned chaplains also to units, to battalions, to brigades. So your job becomes many faceted. You know, you become not only the chaplain to the Jews on the base and their families and their children, but you become the chaplain to everybody in your unit, whatever religion they are. And you have to provide religion as it is written in the First Amendment. Your job is a provider of religion, whatever they may be. To give you an example of what I did to provide religion, when I was at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. They just had a baseball game there a few days ago, yesterday. I was there for 2.5 years, and I was in a signal brigade, 35th Signal Brigade. For about 6 or 7 weeks, the brigade went out to the field to Camp Lejeune, which is a Marine base, for exercises. But the signal people, who are the communication people, have to go early and come back late because they have to set up all their machines for communications. So every Sunday, they let me be on. I was the head chaplain for it. Three or four Christian chaplains worked under me, plus chaplain's assistants, and they had to salute me. That was a great thing. No, I'm only kidding. I don't like getting saluted. It means I have to salute back, and it takes too much effort. No. But anyways, I went out to the field, to Camp Lejeune, either by helicopter or by a Jeep, every Sunday. And I went out with a Catholic priest because we didn't have a priest in our unit, and we had soldiers who were Catholic. So I had to bring a Catholic priest out to the field in the middle of the woods in Camp Lejeune. So it was very funny because he was doing the communion, the mass, the whole service in one tent, you know, with all the Catholics. And I'm nearby. Then afterwards, I become like the president. I said, I'm making an announcement that confession will be to your tent to the left. I'm telling the Catholics to go to confession. Could you believe that? Only in the army, only in the American army, by the way, that these things would happen. And I remember another time I take the same Catholic priest out to the field. Nobody shows up. They all went swimming. I was not a happy camper because we all had to get up about 4 o'clock in the morning to do nothing. So people don't like to do that normally. But those are some of the things I had to do. So a few of the highlights. How much time do I have, by the way? You tell me. Okay. Till Tuesday. So again, you know, my stories are not that exciting because I didn't go to war. People who came back from the first Gulf War, the second Gulf War, from Afghanistan, and there were rabbis there, they really have stories. If you come back, you have stories. If you don't come back, not too many. But nevertheless, some of these were very interesting. My first assignment, and I knew it was somewhere in Texas, was El Paso, Texas, and which is West Texas in the desert, at Fort Bliss, Texas, which is an air defense school. So in my first year, we had about 100 Israelis who showed up. They were coming from San Antonio at the Air Force Base there to learn the advanced Hawk missile air defense system. And I remember for Pesach, we had a Seder at the NCO club, non-commissioned club, and these guys come marching in like soldiers, which they were, more or less, into the club for the Seder. And in talking about kosher food, somebody mentioned you keep kosher. We had a Jewish chapel, and for the whole week, we had a kosher kitchen, a Pesach kitchen for anybody who came, especially the Israelis who needed, and there were many, there were some datiyim, misoratim, that were there that ate in our kitchen. So we took care of them at Fort Bliss. When I was in Korea, 1988, they sent me to Korea for 2 years. And I remember I went to the Pentagon, you know, and to the personnel section, the chaplain personnel section. They said, you know, we want to send you to Korea. That's one of those secrets nobody knows about. Everybody, you know, you think it's so far away, but it's a real secret. You'll love it. They're waiting for you. You know, the guy's a salesman. He could have been a salesman in a car dealership. He's trying to sell me to go to Korea for 2 years. What am I going to do there? Eat kimchi all day long? I don't know. Anyways, I did. It so happened in 1988, the Olympics was going to take place in the fall in Seoul, Korea. And I was going to be in the middle of the Olympics. NBC, which covers the Olympics, I think they still do, requested a rabbi, because they had so many people working for NBC who were Jewish, and it was going to take place, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and Sukkot, that they wanted a rabbi. So they said, you don't need one, because there is one in town. And I became known. I was, if you take a look in Jewish newspapers around the country, my name, my picture, everything was in every local Jewish newspaper. I'm the rabbi for the Olympics. And I got quoted and I got questions. You know, it's a whole thing. But I became the rabbi for the Olympics to include the whole NBC delegation, all the Israelis that came. They had about 20 athletes and about 20 managers and about 20 security people, basically. The athletes from American Jewish athletes, media from around the country, and tourists from around the world. So how am I going to take care of them? And they were going to be there at Rosh Hashanah. So a few things I had to do. We had somebody from the Zimlines, an Israeli from Zimlines, who represented Israel, who was the point man for the Israelis, and I went with him to the Olympic Village. I had to set up a shul in the Olympic Village because on Yom Kippur, the Israelis were going to be there. So I dressed up in my uniform, and I took a Torah with me. They borrowed a Torah. And they had special forces, Korean special forces, at every little gate. And I walked through.
Does the military keep Torahs for you?
That's a good question. I'll talk about that. So I brought it. We had two Torahs, I think, in the Jewish chapel. And I brought one Torah to the Olympic Village to set up the synagogue for the Israelis. Rosh Hashanah, they were going to be with me. And Yom Kippur, they were going to stay there. And they brought their own Chazen, too, who actually was from the Mizrahi Sports Association, which is called Elitzur. And he was my Baal Tefillah for Rosh Hashanah, too. So I'm walking through all these checkpoints in the Olympic Village, and I see these Korean Special Forces guys who look pretty tough. And they're looking at me, and first of all, they've never seen this, and I say, Torah, Torah, Torah! You know, that was a movie, you remember that with Torah?
Yeah.
I say, and they never stopped me. Not once did they say, well, what is this? You know, maybe you're hiding something in there. You know, maybe, who knows? That's why I wore my uniform, because they like uniforms. Especially if they're an ally. So I got through every check station in the Olympic Village. And when I gave them some machzorim and talesim and yarmulkes, whatever they needed, which was an interesting story. So then the other dilemma I had to deal with was security. And because the base that we were on was a closed base, and everybody was going to come to shul, to our chapel. And we were in one of these, what they call communal chapels or ecumenical chapels. It was fairly new, and it was in the circular. So any terrorists would come, they would see me, me first, because I'm right here, you know, standing up in the middle, and they would shoot me first. That's really reassuring. But anyways, I met with intelligence officers, and we went through all the different scenarios, as well as the Israeli security, to make sure that nothing happens, because they were afraid, number one, of North Koreans. They were afraid of people against Israel, against America. So it was a little bit nerve-wracking. It was interesting, though. So I had my Baal Musaf was from Israel. He represented the Religious Zionist Sports Association. And I gave, I think, the Haftorah in the morning was from ABC. So because and for Maftir Yonah was from I think NBC. We had people who knew how to do these things, and all my sermons were somewhat connected to sports, you know. But that was very exciting, and I got some free tickets to some of the games from some of the people who were announcers. We had some announcers that came to show. So one of the interesting things is that Israel, who did not participate, they're not supposed to participate on Yom Kippur. They're by law, they cannot participate. And they had a very good person who was a sailor in a boat, you know. And there was a possibility of getting a medal, and they wouldn't change the event for the Israelis. And somebody from the Washington Post newspaper called me. What do you think? You think the Olympic Committee is correct? You know, they asked me. I said, I don't think they're correct. Anyways, I became the spokesman. And then after the Olympics, they had a party. The Israelis had a party at one of the hotels, and they gave me a certificate that I helped them out, which was very interesting. I tell you which was interesting too was I spent 3 years in Germany, and I was in Munich for 1 year, and then Nuremberg. Both places were hotbeds of early Nazism, the beer halls of Nuremberg and Munich. And we had the military every year for many, many years, the Jewish population, we had a retreat. They called it a Torah convocation, and they had it most of the time in Birch's Garden. And I don't even know where Birch's Garden. Birch's Garden is the German Alps. And that's where Hitler had his retreats. So after the war, we took over all the hotels of Birch's Garden. We were in the Alpine Inn that year, and I think Alpine Inn was one of the hotels that Hitler used for his vacation retreats. So we had a Jewish retreat. So, I mean, it's a little bit unsettling, at the same time very settling, that we brought Jewish life back to Germany, and they couldn't defeat us. So I remember that place very well. The head cook was old enough to know better, and everything was glot with him, because anybody did anything wrong, he'd shoot him, I think, this guy, the head cook. I think it was Wolfgang something. But anyways, I remember that very well. In Germany especially, as well as Korea, the rabbi was a traveling rabbi. I didn't have that many other duties except to be a rabbi, because there wasn't enough rabbis around. So in Korea, I was the only rabbi. So I had a little business card. I was the chief rabbi of the Republic of Korea. The only rabbi of the Republic of Korea. And everybody used to exchange cards. And, you know, it was. So we had all kinds of interesting people in Korea. We had one guy. He claimed he was Jewish, but he was Korean. He used to come Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur dressed like the Kohen Gadol. He had traditional Korean garb, because they have special dress, you know. And he gave a nice donation too. So you never, you know, whatever he was, but he gave a nice donation, and a very interesting guy. And we had Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, as well as the holidays, at the Religious Retreat Center, and we kashered the place, and we had all the meals there. The soldiers around the peninsula used to come and sleep there, and had all their meals there, and we had all our siddurim there. One little story, which is fascinating, that I was jotting, you know, I want to write these things down before I forget. I'm not getting any younger either, but when I was in Korea during the Olympics, so I went to the finals of the United States against the Soviet Union's volleyball championship for the gold medal. I went to the finals. So I was sitting up with another soldier. I had a yarmulke on. I didn't wear my uniform, but a yarmulke on. So somebody right below me sees me, this guy with a beard, a young fellow. He says to me, he figures I must be Jewish or something like that. He says, are they going to have, it was Erev Sukkot, the games took place. Are they having Sukkot services anywhere in Seoul? I said, yeah, they are. It's going to be at the Religious Retreat Center. I said, where are you staying? At the Hyatt. Oh, it's only 2 blocks from the Hyatt. And we started talking. This guy was an orthopedic surgeon from Chicago. The last name was Wallen. And his father was my mother's orthopedic doctor. And he's the son. He was in Korea for some type of conference. And possibly the rumor was that they're related to me. Of all people, you see somebody that's Jewish, that knows the family, that came from the same town in Europe, and wants to come to shul. And he came. I gave him hagba. He was a big guy. I gave him hagba. So, you know, you never know what's going to happen.
Maybe we should open for questions.
Okay.
If anybody has any questions.
Yes.
Did you have a wife that dealt with all this?
Sometimes. No, actually, my wife...
How many?
Huh? Half a dozen, no. No, I just had one. But when I was in Korea the first year, she wasn't with me because she was pregnant with my third son, Yoni. And so we decided to have the baby in Washington, D.C. At Walter Reed. So she wasn't there for this Olympic stuff. But she did, and she was a great, great support. In many, many ways, you know, she never knew who was coming over for supper or sleeping over, because people just came, and you know, nowadays you want to ask your wife, could we have somebody? You know, would be the right thing. But we were Judaism, 101. We were it. Without us, there was nothing. So. You know, we had people, I'll give you an example of, in Germany, they had a big military exercise. It was called Reforger. It was a mobilization exercise, which means they wanted to test how quickly American soldiers and forces could come from the United States to Germany. This was the height of the Cold War. And again, everything takes place during Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. I don't know why, but that's what the day, because it's a good weather, it's the fall, and it took place. And it took place in my area, and I was responsible for religious services for all the Jews that are coming from everywhere. So I, you know, part of the time I went out to the field and played soldier in the field with my uniform and set up services, stuff like that, but for the holidays itself, Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, they came to me if they wanted to come to Jewish services. So I set up barracks for them to sleep and meals. So it was Erev Yom Kippur. We get a phone call from somebody, the chaplain. We got 10 soldiers from Fort Riley, Kansas. They just came from Fort. They need food. Before the fast and after the fast, then he placed to sleep. Everything was prepared. I had places for them to sleep. My wife, in between Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, she cooked all week and froze. We had no idea what we're going to get. So we got about 10 soldiers that showed up at the door with their chaplain's assistant and their own chaplains. One was a Unitarian and one was a Baptist. They came. And we had turkey and all the food ready to go. And I couldn't have done that without my wife, to tell you the truth, because I don't know if my food would have been as good. I mean, maybe I would have hired a cook or something. And we had, plus some other people that were there before and stayed at our house. So I remember the two Christian chaplains, they, you know, I said, you know, you have to fast. I told the soldiers, you know, they're gonna fast all day. So they asked me, do we have to fast too? So I said, no, you don't have to. If you want to, it's okay, but you don't have to. But we had...
Here's a box of 700 pages.
We had, I don't know, maybe 15, 20 people for before the fast. Just as an example. Now, we talking about kashrut, the military has what they call a commissary. Those of you who have ever been in the army, have been to military bases, the commissary is where you buy food. And they could get kosher chicken, meat, if you ask for it. And in Germany, they had Empire chickens and turkeys. And they also, oh, thank you. They also had a brand which doesn't exist anymore because it was shut down, but it was under OU. It was called Lundy's. I don't know if you remember Lundy's. It was out of Philadelphia. There was a scandal. It's no longer. But we had Lundy's in Germany and also in Korea. We had We had some, I think we had Lundy's also, and some other beef, whatever it was. I want to tell you a story about problems. Two problems which happened to me. Here, if for some reason they run out of matzah at Hungarian, you go to Jewel or someplace. There, if you run out of matzah in the middle of Seoul, Korea, you got a problem. Or if you have the wrong matzah. So when I got to Seoul, in the Jewish, we had a little shul that was just ours. I see on the cupboards, I see all kinds of matzah. And it says, not for Passover use. What do you have all that stuff here for? So I asked, you know, my lay leader, I says, why do you have all this stuff? Well, it's because the year before, when the guy ordered matzah in the commissary, the Korean nationals, they ordered matzah, and they ended up ordering matzah that said not for Passover use. So, same thing happened. So I go to the commissary office, and I said, I want to see what you're ordering, because I want to make sure this doesn't happen again. And when it comes in, I want to see. So I looked at it. About a week before Pesach, I go to the commissary, I take a look, and it says, not for Passover use. I got 1 week to pay Pesach. So we had a scramble. So we had a friend that was coming in for Pesach for whatever reason from Los Angeles. He brought some stuff. And we had somebody, from Fort Lee. We had a lieutenant colonel, my shul, who was in the, he was a officer that provided, all the supplies. So he calls up the commander-in-chief of that division, you know, really getting upset. We don't have any matzah. So the head guy who's coming to Korea, who was a two-star general, he goes to Seattle, goes to the store, and gets as much matzah as he can, and brings it in by cargo plane. So somehow we got it. We got some stuff from Japan, too. Yes?
A young man today who's like wants to enlist in illicit services.
Yes.
How accommodating is basic training for kashrus, Shabbos,
davening? I'm glad that you asked that question. Much better today than it was years ago. When I got in 75, in the field, like if you're out in the field training, they had what they call, now they call it MREs. Not MRI is a test. MREs, which is meals ready to eat. And they're like, they have a bunch of stuff in it. Some of the things that are in it may be kosher, like tuna fish, maybe some crackers. But in 1990, in the first Gulf War, a lot of reservists were called up. And there was quite a few people who kept kosher. So I was stationed there, and I went to the Pentagon to work on a kosher MRE. And to this day, they finally came up with the vendor from, I think, Northbrook or Deerfield. It's a company.
My own meals.
Correct. My Own Meals got the contract. And to this day now, you know, you could choose. Anybody could choose in the field to have My Own Meal. The food is not bad also. And they have a shelf life of about 10 years, and it doesn't have to be refrigerated. So they are much more accommodating. And they just allowed, I think, a year or two ago, chaplains who want to wear a beard to come into the army, they could have a beard. And they never did that before. On reserves, they did. So you're not going to find the minion probably every day. You may find it if you're on a military base, a large one with a rabbi that's assigned there. There may be a minion on Shabbos. But during the week, you're going to have to pray on your own.
But then if, like, basic training, they're waking you up at, what, 4 a.m. or so?
Yeah.
So you basically have to wake up almost like an hour earlier to get in your davening, and you're davening.
Well, that's if you could daven so early. I mean, there's a limit to when you could daven chakras, so you may have to daven a little later after you do your physical fitness or whatever it is, you know. All right. I think in general, the American military is pretty sensitive. They are sensitive to religion, and they will make accommodations for you, especially if you're a good soldier. If you're not a good soldier and you ask for everything, your life could be miserable. Trust me. You have to show that you could do what everybody else can do. You could shoot, you could, you know, your military bearing, you know, you could run, do exercises. But if you're not a good soldier, it could be harder. But they're pretty accommodating. And that's where you have the unit chaplains help you, even if they're not Jewish. They'll help you, you know, you ask them for time off. And when I was in Fort Dix, which was basic training, before the major holidays, we said we had to do a memo throughout the whole place to allow Jewish soldiers to go home for the holidays or for Pesach or to get off for those days. So they were very well aware that, you know, Jewish soldiers could get off. Yes.
So I understand that you have to service all of the soldiers who ask for it. How do you counsel soldiers that are not Jewish?
How do I counsel them? Like, well, if it's a religious issue that requires religious consultation, then I'll refer them to a Christian chaplain. But if it's not, most issues are not necessarily religious. They are, you know, sometimes you have issues of, let's say, suicide. Soldiers are suicidal. They're depressed. They want to go home because somebody's sick in the family. They want to change assignments because of some family concerns. So that any chaplain could do those things, which I did. You know, I've taken soldiers to the hospital because I thought they were suicidal. They had issues with their command. Or I even had, interestingly, in Korea, a female soldier who was Christian who came to me because she did not want to do the exercises in the shorts. She was very modest. She came from a religious Christian environment. It's not only the Jews have a concept of sniyut, they did too. So she came to me as a chaplain, happened to be there in this particular, because she wanted to get an exemption so she could wear a skirt or something else instead of shorts, which is the usual dress when you do exercises when it's 95 degrees outside. You know, the military would be concerned about heat strokes if you wear something too heavy, you know. But nevertheless, she came to me as a chaplain, and I wrote her a letter to her unit saying that because of religious reasons, she should be allowed to wear something more modest according to her, you know, whatever her religious philosophy was.
And we'll take one last question.
Yes.
And we'll bench after.
Okay.
What prompted you to go into the military?
What prompted me? That's a good question. First of all, when I finished smicha, I was still single. And when I went to Yeshiva University, they promoted it. They encouraged it, actually. The head of the vice president for student affairs, Rabbi Miller, Izzy Miller, was in the Air Force. The head of rabbinic alumni was a reserve colonel. And they felt that, you know, it's much easier as a rabbi and being single. I mean, I wouldn't find too many Jewish girls. That's another whole lecture about dating. Dating when you're single in the middle of nowhere. That's a story into itself, which is sometimes very humorous. But they thought, rather than go into the rabbinate, which has its old, you know, you're not too seasoned, you're just coming out of school, you'll learn a lot about a lot of things without the pressure of boards, of directors, and, you know, so do that first. So they actually encouraged me And I knew a chaplain in Chicago, also was a friend of my father, Oscar Lipschitz. I don't know if you heard of him.
Sure.
He was the last rabbi. Well, one of the, he was a rabbi at Agudas Acham North Shore. And he was an infamous Jewish chaplain, and he went to the yeshiva here, HDC, years ago. I knew him, and my father knew him, so I went in. I really didn't know what I was. Another thing that I liked about it, which fit my personality, was there was a lot of kiruv. You have an opportunity galore to makariv people. And I did a lot of that because I was an NCSY, I was a youth advisor. So it was just an extension of what I was doing in the past. And Uncle Sam gave me a lot of money to do whatever I wanted, mostly. So I did. And I did a lot of that. You know, that was not so much different than what I did, except I did it with a uniform on, that's all.
Did you ever experience anti-Semitism?
I tell you the truth. Not really. What I did experience sometimes was when they decided to make rabbis, they put them in units, and they wanted them to have the opportunities to be unit chaplains like anybody else. Some of the commanders didn't want rabbis. Why? Because how many Jews are in their unit? What do you take? You know, their mentality was, if there is 500 Catholics, why do we need a rabbi? You need a Catholic. Or if there's 1,000 Protestants, that was their mentality. But the chaplaincy didn't view it that way. They would say a major is a major is a major, and a major should become a brigade chaplain. But some of the commanders, especially a commander's base like a Fort Bragg, they didn't look at it that way, and it was hard. It was hard putting yourself in a place where you were really a minority. So that was not easy.
Maybe we'll bench now. Thank you very much, everybody. Yeah.